Senator Phillips, Senator Jaroff, Senator Sharp, Senator Frank, and myself, as well as Senators Lehman and Green. We have before us committee substitute for Senate Bill 1003. And Senator Miller, I believe, has a committee substitute to propose and explain to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Senator Miller. I represent the Senate District Q, which is North Pole and parts of Fairbanks and parts of the Parks Highway. Before you have a proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 1003, it is essentially before you is Senate Bill 152, which passed in the waning hours of the regular session, which essentially would have done a number of things. First of all, it would, in my opinion, probably the two most important things it would have done. It will create a Tier 3 system in the retirement plan that we now have under PERS for public employees. And secondly, it would approve the contracts for all the covered folks, and it would also include in that a raise for all the non-covered folks that we have under state employment, or most of them. Also included in the bill is the RIP version retirement incentive program, which the administration has put forward. On a floor amendment made in the Senate, the SIP part, the separation incentive program, was taken out on the floor, so therefore it has been deleted in this particular bill. Like I say, this is basically essentially the bill that passed the Senate. The only difference is there were some technical changes that the administration said that needed to be made in some of the wording. Those technical changes were made. They're very minor in nature. And Commissioner Boyer is here, and I know he knows what those technical changes were. Also, we dealt with the cost of living differential for the Marine Highway. The only difference there was that we took the eligibility requirements out of the PFDs for folks to be eligible for COLD, which the administration says will probably save them. And in the notes that we have from them from 152, which they say that they would save probably about $120,000 a year, although I understand that could be a little bit higher. And also we have in this bill geographical differentials, which essentially probably the biggest portion of it is right now the non-covereds in the Fairbanks area are roughly 15%. I believe it's 14.9. This would reduce them to a 4% differential, which are the same essentially as the covered employees are in Fairbanks. And there would be some savings there, plus it would reduce the other areas of the state that have a differential. I believe Barrow would drop from 44% to 20%. I believe Bethel would drop. I believe they currently are at 37% or thereabouts, and they would drop also to 20%. Essentially, again, this is the administration's bill that was put forward except for the change for the Fairbanks area. And also, from numbers that have been generated by the Department of Administration, in the first year in FY97, the GEO difference would be only about $30,000. But in the second year at FY98, with the current language that's in this bill at 4% for Fairbanks, according to numbers that we were given to at the end of the session, this would still generate a savings in the GEO difference of about $1.3 million. Those are the major highlights of the bill. I know that we discussed this bill considerably the night it was on the floor, so I know that most of you are fairly familiar with the bill and what it does. Again, I just would like to stress that I believe it's an important step that we have to take in order to get some long-term changes in the way that we do business around here, and I believe that this will help to get some long-term savings on some of the salaries that we do pay. Again, I would also like to stress, as it was stressed that night, that this only affects new hires. It does not affect in Tier 3. It does not affect any of those employees that are currently hired. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator Phillips.
Two questions here. One, this does not affect SBS as well, right?
Does not affect SBS. That is current, right.
Second question is, are there any changes in this bill other than what we passed the other night?
Just some minor technical changes, which the administration came forward, some technical changes to make it to read a little bit better. And again, like Commissioner Boyer can have those, would have those changes because they were brought forth. And again, they're just minor technical changes. There are no substantive changes in this bill as what passed the floor the other night. There were some floor amendments that were added in debate, but those amendments have been incorporated on those in this bill, those amendments that were adopted by the Senate as a whole and moved out of the Senate. Yes, one, the probably the major changes I remember it was the on those folks that will be the some 97 employees in Fairbanks that are non-covered that will be dropping from 14.9% cost of living, a geo difference to 4% was an amendment that was offered to restrict what they would be losing in any given year by 5%. That was, as I remember, I believe that was the really only major amendment that was adopted.
Senator Sharp?
Yeah, that other than what the elimination of SIP.
Yes, and the, excuse me, that was the other major amendment, the elimination of SIP, yes.
The third one, I think, might have been the Seattle differential.
Seattle differential?
The Seattle differential was changed from a minus 10 to a minus 20. That was originally passed out of Senate Finance. That was a change that you originally made in 152.
One of the other things in the geographic differential bill was whether the cost of living applied to the entire salary, to the first 20 or 30,000 or 40,000 or 50,000. What's this bill provide?
The bill that passed out of Senate Finance provided, I believe, for Fairbanks, it was a 5% cost of differential on the first 50,000. This changes it to a 4% on the entire amount. Because there was some discussion by the administration that going to a 5%, that would help reopen the contracts for those covered employees when actually would actually cost about $13,000 more, because those covered employees would probably be eligible under the contracts to go to 5% from a 4% on that amount. So it actually, by limiting it to 5% on a certain amount, would actually boost the overall cost versus having a 4% on the entire amount.
Of course, the other thing that happens, though, is that the high scale gets more, the low scale gets less.
Whenever you do that, yes, that is correct.
What's the phase-in provision in this draft of the geographic cost differential changes?
I believe it starts, and Commissioner Boyer, he might have remember some of these things. I believe it starts next year, but there is also the limitation that starts on the with a floor amendment that you cannot lose more than 5% in any given year. So you lose 5%. Even though maybe it's scheduled to have a bigger decrease, you'd only lose 5%, and then the next year you would.
Does that 5% include the 1.5% scale increase this year, for example? Or does that freeze it so that it takes it back out as it comes? If you're above scale.
Right.
You get the 1.5% effective this year and then freeze at the higher level.
That's a good question. I believe you would probably get the 1.5%, but you would still have to drop the 10% or almost 11%. So instead of dropping essentially 11%, you're probably only dropping 9% or whatever.
Senator Frank?
Yeah. Every time you've asked me that question, I've just answered it by saying, well, you drafted it, Mr. Chairman.
No, I drafted it at your request, and we changed it back and forth. Maybe Mr. Boyer can tell us.
Administration will have to tell us how they will interpret it.
Exactly.
Nine down to 12.
The discussion we had in finance the last time was that they would interpret it as a cap. and that the cap was before the 1.5% increase. So it would actually come down 6.5% from the otherwise increased base. Senator Miller? You don't have any further answer on that?
I do not. No, I do not.
Are there other questions by other members?
Chairman, I just...
Senator Jarrow.
Just trying to get the understanding on the effective dates on this here. Sections 30, 31, and 39 expire July 1 in the year 2000.
Well, let me find out what those sections are.
RIP program.
Those are the retirement incentive parts, Senator Jarrow, which they had the administration wanted a three-year incentive program. So those are the sections that would be repealed.
And who does that affect, everybody?
From my understanding, it would affect most everybody. However, from my understanding and talking with the administration, they were going to be very selective in those individuals that could use it. That was the impression. But again, I think that would be a question that would be better addressed to Commissioner Boyer.
Okay. Then I'd also ask the next 32 to 36, so maybe I could ask Commissioner Boyer on that as well. This bill ties in Tier 3 system along with everything else.
That is correct.
Okay. I guess I could ask the administration if they support that.
Okay, Senator Miller, if you'll join us at the table. We'll
thank
go
you.
To Commissioner Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I trust that how this bill, proposed CS, has been outlined by the senator from North Pole is accurate, and so I've got confidence that it is. The one other element, though, however, that wasn't, or I don't think is correct in this draft, is one that we found after the amendment had passed on the Senate floor, and that had to do with an amendment offered by Senator Kelly, which was in the debate characterized as a limitation on legislators themselves receiving the 1.4 or 1.5% increases. And the unfortunate thing is the amendment that was offered on the floor is imperfect if that was the intent. We had redrafted a section that accomplished that intent. If the chair is interested in having that, I've got draft language which would have that impact. Legislators like judiciary branch employees are covered under 2410-100, not the section amended by the floor amendment. And so to be clear that legislators are not entitled to the ride up the ramp, you would have to propose an amendment to 2410-100 that would set the legislative salary at $2,001 per month. And I have that language specifically, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like it. I'm sure there was just an imperfectly drafted amendment.
This is part of the technical amendments there.
Mr. Chairman, no, it is not. The the perfecting amendments incorporated into this bill after the floor session were literally technical problems that we had a line that was dropped off, for instance, on one of the pages, just a typing error. The other was inadvertent, because of the hurry of things, an inadvertent reference to one of the to two contracts, distinctly different contracts, each as Alaska Votech, and one of them actually both as Alyeska Central School. One of them is distinctly different and needed to read Alaska Votech, and those couple of amendments were technical in nature and were incorporated here. However, the substantive amendment that I just referred to was not picked up here, and we had hoped that we would then be able to insert it at a later time, and so I have it. It's available if the committee...
I want to clarify that.
Senator Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that was certainly the intent of the person that offered the amendment on the floor, and that was certainly my intent. And I was under the impression that we already were set by dollar amount in statute.
That's correct.
A separate item versus being in the staff. But yes, we wanted to make sure that it did not cover legislators per se. That was my intent, and it was also the intent of the offer of the
Senator Kelly in discussing them. You know, I would view that as a very friendly amendment to take care of that technical problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it's actually a very simple one line, or it's actually, it ends up being several lines, but it's a very simple amendment. And I think it's section 40, 49 of that bill.
Okay. That's not appropriate.
Yeah, and you would need a sub A or something of that, but you would need to insert AS 2410-100 with an amendment to read the monthly salary for each member of the legislature is, and then underlined $2,001. The president of the Senate, and you know, covers their $500. But that I've got the language here, and that's the essence of it, Mr. Chairman, is to keep your salary the same, which was the intent of the amendment. On other elements of the bill, Mr. Chairman, as you know, the process did continue on after the bill passed the Senate, and we were very interested in having some additional changes made to the bill. Some changes were, in fact, made by the House Finance Committee before that bill went to the floor, the version of the bill went to the floor. And not knowing the intent of the committee chair at this point, we would reserve an opportunity to offer some additional changes, or at least discuss additional changes that we'd like to see made in the bill. Our position with this version for you is that the administration does not support the bill. If we are looking at a way to finance the cost of the contracts, we have alternative approaches that we think make more sense, and frankly, Mr. Chairman, approaches that were bargained in good faith at the bargaining table with three of the major unions to reopen their contracts, and as was characterized by the chairman, a 5% differential or a 5% differential in Fairbanks would not have opened the contracts to our benefit, would have opened them to the benefit of the unions. A change was made to move that percentage to 4%, albeit over a two-year phased period, and thereby reducing the savings to about $600,000 a year over those two periods. Moving it to 4%, not reopening the contracts, so that the $7.5 million of additional savings associated with reopening the contracts is an opportunity missed by the legislature, and that amount, coincidentally, is not far off the new cost of the contracts negotiated by the administration. It was our intent at the bargaining table to use the total $8.5 million, $8.7 million to finance our contracts. And that has been the center of the debate, how we finance the contracts. We bargained them with that assumption in mind that we'd have available to us the money and the geographic differential to accomplish that purpose.
Questions? Senator Phillips.
The bill in its present form, the administration does not support. Is that
correct?
That's
correct, Mr. Chairman.
Does the administration support a separate from the two parts of this bill, the state employees' pay raise as well as the RIP, separate that issue and just isolate Tier 3? Do they support Tier 3?
Do we support Tier 3?
Let's say if we pass a bill by itself, Tier 3, will the administration veto it?
I can't speak to the whether or not the governor would veto it. However, our position on adjournment night was that we would support a change to the eligibility for receiving retiree health benefits. The current time that a person must be in state service before they're eligible for a retiree health benefit is 5 years. We supported changing that eligibility time frame from 5 years to 10 years. And at that point, the retiree would drop into the current Tier 2 employee or retiree and family option at 100%. And over time, I think, while I don't have the form in front of me, we had additive savings in the neighborhood of $12 million over a period of time.
Period of time, what, 5, 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, I think the additive, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I would take a minute to find them.
But it's more than 1 year, then, $12 million savings.
Yes, it's more than 1 year.
Senator Rieger, then Senator Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you mentioned other issues that were either addressed in House Finance or issues that you were interested in, and you mentioned the geographic differential in Fairbanks. What were the other issues?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I missed the meeting, was involved with other business, but I think there were two amendments made in the House Finance Committee. One eliminated what had been Section 12 that related to moving the staff of the Labor Relations Office in my department out of the confidential service or out of the classified service into the partially exempt service. That's where they have been historically. It's only been the last 10 months, or I suppose about a year, that they've been covered under the classified system. And so I suppose that the interest was in moving them back into the partially exempt service, and one other amendment that I don't recall right off the top of my head.
Why would we want to pass Section 12? It's back in this bill as Section 12 again, I think.
You're asking me, Mr. Chairman? Knowles administration came into office, there were a number of issues that were 30-day kind of horizon issues, and one of those 30-day horizon needed attention kinds of issues was a decision whether or not to challenge before the Superior Court a decision, an arbitrator's decision, on the question of whether or not public employees, and specifically the human resource managers that were created during the last administration, whether or not that group of people and others of like nature, similar in nature, were entitled to protections and bargaining under collective bargaining under the PARA. The arbitrator's decision found that that group of employees, the human resource managers and other like employees, were entitled to the protections and the rights to collectively bargain under PARA, and we chose then not to challenge that arbitrator's decision before the Superior Court. Again, historically, those people had been in the partially exempt service. A number of them are direct policy-making individuals. One is a manager, and three others are policy positions by any characterization, although, in theory, those members in the classified service are not policy-making positions. However, they act, I can assure you, in policy-making capacities with me as advisors on labor relations issues at the very highest level. And I think that is clearly one of the interests that one would have in moving those people out of the classified back into the partially exempt service.
I guess we have to hear from the House why they took it out. I don't know what the answer is. Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a technical question there. Part of the components of the call called for dealing with the contracts. And does this bill in its entirety fall under that call, or is this, because I don't remember specifically saying that you were going to deal with Tier 3 or anything else.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know from the Attorney General whether or not he's given an opinion whether or not this title fits under the call. Chairman may have a better take on that legal issue. However, the governor has said that if we can address the three large issues, the operating capital reappropriations pieces of legislation and the employee contract funding, that he would be open to additional issues perhaps being addressed at that time, but he wanted the focus. He very much wants to see the focus of those big ticket issues addressed first.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, on that, there, do we have an opinion on that as to whether that this bill in its entirety is under the call?
No, we don't.
We don't.
The call basically said the funding of the contracts and those actions necessary to fund the contracts. The question is whether this is an action necessary to fund the contract. I think it could be interpreted either way. Senator Rieger?
I'm curious, was it the governor's intent to specifically exclude consideration of these items in his proclamation?
Mr. Chairman, I was not involved with the actual deliberations moments before adjournment of the regular session, so I can't address that issue.
And you don't know?
I don't know. But I do know that in conversations since then, that the goal of the administration is to have the three major issues, outstanding large monetary issues, addressed, and to the extent that they are addressed, there, I think, is some expectations that agreeable people can agree to additions to get the business before the state concluded quickly. I know I'm speaking in code, Mr. Chairman, but I think you all understand and can appreciate what I'm saying.
Well, the message isn't. The message seems to be a little in conflict with the substance of the proclamation. If you're saying, well, other things are open for discussion, but I'm going to send a proclamation that excludes them. And I'm trying to figure out where the administration is coming from on that point.
Proclamations, Mr. Chairman, can be amended.
In other words, the door is open.
Mr. Chairman, we're very interested in a speedy and smooth end to the special session.
Senator Frank?
Mark, is it the governor's position that he wants to cut the Fairbanks employees 4%? Is that from the governor, or is that just your idea?
Mr. Chairman, the idea of taking a look at the differentials across the state, not just in Fairbanks, but across the state, was one that the previous administration had entertained. The previous administration had drafted legislation to that effect. The previous administration had funded.
Hold it now. I just asked you if the
Mr.
governor
Chairman.
Is for the 4% cut, or is that you that is for the 4% cut? Because you've talked about it repeatedly, both here and elsewhere.
Mr. Chairman, if the question is about my opinion, I would move those people who are currently receiving 14.9% in Fairbanks to zero, and I would base that decision on at least two empirical documents, fresh reviews of from the last quarter of 1995, both indicating that Fairbanks, at the most, should only be receiving a 2.5% differential, and in the other case, a zero differential, Mr. Chairman. So my decision, if it were mine, would be to move Fairbanks to zero. That had been my position at the bargaining table last March when I was in negotiations with the GGU. We inserted language in that contract that said if the legislature passed a bill that amended or modified the provisions of the geographic differential so that it fell under the current contract 4% rate in Fairbanks, that we would reopen the contract in an expedited fashion, bargain that issue only.
What would you give up? What would you give up in that bargaining position?
In that bargaining position?
I mean, you're going to go in and bargain. What would you have to give up to get this?
Mr. Chairman, the history of the bargaining on that particular issue is that it was 85 or 86, the unions, which had to that point a similar differential for the Fairbanks area, at the bargaining table then opened themselves to that element and bargained, and ended with a position that they didn't support, which went to an arbitrator, and an arbitrator finally determined the 4%. So the 4% came from an arbitrated dispute as a result of collective bargaining. When I was at the bargaining table this year, I was looking again to find ways to reduce the cost of public employees. This clearly is an area that is ripe for debate. At the table, I had the discussion and attempted to negotiate the rate. However, the unions, having been abused of the process earlier, as I said, about 1986, said essentially that if you go and get a rate reduction for those people not covered, the highest paid public employees in Fairbanks, if you can get the differential reduced for them, we will open our contract and negotiate similar terms. So it was a give and take at the table that focused on reopening contracts as well as going first to a piece of legislation that would deal with the non-covered employees.
Well, let me just restate my question. Is it your position or is it the governor's position that you cut workers' pay in Fairbanks by 4%?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, it's the governor's position to take that differential to zero in Fairbanks, to take it from 44% in Barrow and other northern areas to 20%, in Bethel from 37.5% to 20%, keep the 10% differential along the eastern rail area from Cordova Valdez up into the interior Tok Delta area, and continue the 5% differential in southeastern with the exceptions of Ketchikan and Juneau, which would remain at zero as they are currently. That's the governor's position today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you. Through the chair, if there's not that many positions involved, the way I understand it, but the way this would work is that the ones at 14% non-bargaining people would have a 10% cut over a few years. They would get to 1.5%.
They would, under the bill as drafted, they would continue to receive the increases not only in pay for non-covers, but they would also, if they have opportunities, they would get merit increases as well as longevity increases during that time as well.
So they would see a net of 8.5% decrease. And the collective bargaining people would see a 1.5% increase.
That's actually not quite correct. They would see over the 3 years of the language that's in the bill characterizing a 4.4% raise environment, they would come down in the first year by 5% and would go up by 1.4%. In the second year, they would come down by, I think, 4.9% and would go up again by 1.5%. So the net, and let's just call the net 9 down to 4, or 14.9 down to 5, or 4 rather. So a 10% change, they'd ride up 3%, roughly 2.9 or 3% of that amount. And if they were receiving longevity or merit increases in any of those years, and some of those people have merit increases of 3.5% in each of those years. So you could have an employee that takes a 9% or 10% reduction and at the end of the three-year period would ride up 15 or 16% and receive no, ultimately, at that end of the 3 years, no reduction in pay.
But during that time, those three increases of 1.5% you're talking about, the collective bargaining people gets that too.
That's correct,
so Mr. They'd be going up 5% over a three-year period. And also, doesn't some of the collective bargaining agreements have some merit increases or also? So I'm just trying to maintain the spread of who's getting cut. And you know, it's awful hard for me to say, you know, they got merit increases, the collective bargaining, and so does the non-bargaining. And both of them would get the 1.5% over the 3 years. So the net effect is they're going to lose 8.5% more than when it comes down to netting everything out to get the deal. And I guess, has there been any studies performed that would show if this went into effect, how many of the district directors or deputy directors up there, regional directors, would, that's in fairly high supervisory responsibility areas, would be getting less than the people that work for them after the end of this 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that specific question. However, I do have a list that I could make available to the chair, to the members, that characterizes around 50 employees. These would be I think the list says 62 employees that are in, that are not members of bargaining units on one of the lists. I have an actual payroll run from last week, and about 40 of the 50 on this list make in excess a base wage of $61,000, above which, or on addition, or in addition to which, they would bring in from $9,000 to $15,000 or $14,000 additional monies from the geographic differential. And some of these people, division directors, there are 1, 2, 3, at least three division directors here that would see, that are at the very top end of things, exceeding $103,000 or $104,000 or $105,000 a year, who would receive a reduction at some point over time.
These are the people that get $14,000 out of pay differential right now.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frank.
I'd like to remind the committee and Commissioner Boyer that we have dealt with this issue. We did pass it out in a clean version out of this committee. In fact, I think Senator Sharp and I both voted do pass after the committee chair put out a CS that brought the Fairbanks non-classifieds from 14.9 down to 5 with a delayed, with a phase-in program over 2 years. And so any focus on the pay of these folks, I think, gets us off point. I think the point is that we have dealt with this in a positive fashion. We were willing to support reasonable reductions down to the 5% level. We voted again to support it at a 4% level, and I have no problem in doing that. And I guess I resent the focus being continually brought back to Fairbanks being the problem, and focus brought on the relatively small number of highly compensated employees as the problem. We've already dealt with that twice, both in this committee and on the floor, in a productive manner. And I think we should get on to the real issue, which is long-term costs of employee compensation, including a Tier 3 benefit package, and the unwillingness of your administration to deal with that. That's where I think the focus ought to be, and so that we could get going on something positive.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on the comments by Senator Frank, and I think that sometimes we lose sight in just focusing on the non-coverts, but there are roughly 2,000 employees, state employees in Fairbanks, which do have the 4% cost differential. This, if we reduced it to zero, would open those contracts up for later negotiation to bring them to zero. So although they may receive in the next 3 years 4.5% cost of living wages, if they lose 4%, therefore they have only gained 0.5% over the next 3 years, where every other union worker in the state has, or most every other, those that are not those in Fairbanks or those in Anchorage and Juneau, has received a 4.5% increase. So it's somewhat offensive to me that the administration is out focusing on the Superior and the Fairbanks worker in areas of trying to save money. And quite frankly, I don't understand why the unions representing those folks in Fairbanks that will be affected by this, and it's why the workers aren't upset about it and why the unions aren't upset about it. If I was a worker up there, would be upset about it. But I agree with Senator Frank, we should be looking at the overall universe of all these folks out there. How do we bring some long-term changes instead of focusing at roughly 2,000 people or 4,000 people if you take statewide, that's a geo difference. Let's look at the entire universe of state employees and how do we get some long-term savings, whether it be the retirement system or whatever system that we have.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, our goals are identical. Our goals are identical in as much as we are all, I think, interested in long-term savings. When we began negotiating the contracts and looking at the benefits side of things, our goal was to end up at the end of 4 years with a public employee that was being compensated at about the same level as the middle-of-the-pack employee of the top 100 public or private employers in the state of Alaska. We are a very large employer. We're a big business in the state of Alaska. So our goal was not to be a leader, not to be a follower, to be competitive in the private marketplace on wages and benefits, and our bargaining was geared to accomplish that goal. I mean, depending on how you characterize the numbers, The general overlay is that we have about an 8% difference generally between our state employees and the same group of top 100 employers in the state of Alaska. And by negotiating wages that had zero increases in the first year and then 3 years each of half the CPI, over a four-year period with the private sector people who we know now are moving up at about the CPI. In fact, most contracts negotiated in the last year in Alaska in that top 100 group contain provisions of between 10 and 14% increases over the next 3 years. So we knew clearly that we could reduce that gap between the private sector and the public, the state employers. So our goal has been to do exactly that and to have as a backup to that goal, something that empirically based the numbers, the guesses, and the Fairbanks is not being singled out. The survey we did was a statewide survey. There are two of them available, and actually there are five, I think, available. We used two that characterized these differentials for all over the state, and that's what we patterned our piece of legislation on was across the state. It just so happens that Fairbanks does enjoy a population of about 1,500 covered and non-covered state employees at a cost of, just for the differential, $4.3 million a year. And in an environment where we're trying to pay for the cost of public employees, we looked at the data. The data did not support a continuing 14.9% differential for Fairbanks or a 44% differential for the North Slope and others around the state, and we introduced legislation to bring those down into the marketplace. Those had not been changed for the non-covered since 1972. So we're basing compensation on 24-year-old information, the current information of which does not any longer support that kind of a differential.
Senator Rieger.
Mr. Chairman, does the administration support going to a tier three retirement system?
We would support today, Mr. Chairman, changing the eligibility for receiving health benefits at retirement, and that's the extent of the direction that I've been authorized to go at this point.
So, you know, about a year ago at this table, when the administration brought us this chart, you know, two pages of changes, Senate Finance Committee adopted it all at the administration's request, passed it, sent it to the House. What's changed in the last year that's caused the administration to reverse direction?
I would not characterize this as reversing direction at all. What our priority was last year was what it was last year, and that was to move the interest, Mr. Chairman, of the Speaker to away from a defined contribution environment back to the current environment that we offer benefits under, and that is a defined benefits environment. And we accomplished that with the Senate Finance Committee with the charts and the numbers that are being referenced. So we moved to a better environment from our perspective, of an environment that provides a better benefit, a fairer benefit for public employees. We then spent the fall and late summer going around and meeting with employers that are also impacted by any changes to the PERS system and employee groups, and as a result of many, many hours of discussions with them, developed several alternatives. We call it a menu of options, and it's that menu of options that we have been speaking with members around this table and others about for the last month, Mr. Chairman. So we were interested in a menu kind of approach to the benefits and the costs and the savings. And at this point, on adjournment night, we had offered to move to at least this changed way in determining eligibility for the retirement benefit itself, for health benefit.
So out of the, I don't know what it is, 12 I'm here, you decided that one of them was okay.
One that we would be willing to support.
Was the original package offered in good faith, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, the package I think is being referenced, I'm not being able to see it, was a menu. The package was not adopted and is not the vehicle before you. The package before you has a fraction of the number that's characterized on that page. I think there are four or five changes, Mr. Chairman, five, I think, changes to the system, not the 12 that's being referenced. So it has been a product of discussion and negotiation and reflection, even to get the version that you've passed before you. So and that's the nature of the process, is that you explore all the options, and that characterizes a number of options that were available to all of us.
Senator Frank?
Yeah, I don't recall everything about that process, but I do recall that there was an contribution, and then the administration said, oh, no, can't do that. We'll do this. We'll do a Tier 3, and gave us the list of 12 items. And then once you talked us into moving away from defined contribution to defined benefit, and then you backed away from those 12 items. I think that's what the senator is getting at. And I guess we're wondering about ultimately what your position is.
Mr. Chairman, I've stated clearly several times now that our official position today is that we would support a change in the eligibility for receipt of health benefits at retirement. That's what we're prepared to support today. However, as Senator Frank knows, we have been willing and have been talking over the last several days about a number of options, several of which are not contained in the document before you in a proposed CS. I would characterize the discussion as being continuing to be open, and I appreciate the fact that you've got a vehicle now here potentially before us for actual consideration, but I would say that the administration does not support this bill as it is and would look for a number of changes to this piece of legislation before it passes.
In your opinion, would it be productive to go through the menu of options in terms of what saves what in what time frame? And if we're truly trying to find ways to fund the contract in some part with long-term savings, or the contract, then it would seem that putting all the questions on the table, whether they were supported or not, would at least serve to educate us all on what our choices are.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We did think that it made sense to look at the world of employer cost drivers. That's really what this issue focuses on. What are the costs that drive the expenses of the employer and other public employers up? And there are, any number of main elements, but we had identified 10 or 11 of those items that ought to be considered, particularly given the backdrop of the non-contract driving costs contained in the kind of package of employer contracts. There are, just for rough ease here, $5.6 million worth of administration executive branch contracts, and then additional contracts by the court and legislative branches, and then the world of non-covered. So our negotiated contracts represent just a little over half. Total $11 million. So given that split, we thought it fair also to look, if we were going to look at a menu that included costs that are driving the employer, elements that drive the employer costs as they relate to the non-coverage as well. So we had been looking at things like merit and longevity, leave cash-in values, health flexible benefits plans, that an element that I've been talking to members of the legislature about throughout this session. Elements like that, in addition to those that had been on the table and under discussion at, near the end of the session. So we thought it was healthy over the last couple of days to focus on those, and we continue to think it's a healthy discussion to have, and there's a lot of education that could take place here.
Well, it's just my thought that putting all that stuff on the table, at least so we have an idea what saves money and what doesn't, would be a productive exercise. I mean, some of those things make major changes, but they don't occur until way into the future, so they don't generate a lot of money. Some of the things generate some money now, and some of the things are obviously not worth the argument they create because of the little bit that they generate. And if we could, I mean, I just think it would be productive to put all those things on the table to look at, whether they're supported or not. And Senator Rieger?
I heard also in the testimony that the commissioner, or maybe the governor, is interested in a speedy resolution of the special session. And what I see is a reintroduction from ground zero of every point in this issue, and a reintroduction of every point practically in the budget, what was different between the governor's original proposal. So I think we might as well be prepared to be here till July or August. We're going to take them from scratch again.
It's a great thing that the Constitution limits the special session to 30 days. Mr. Chairman, this issue, I don't mean to make light of this. It's not a complex issue. I think all of you have been through this exercise before. The options are fairly narrow. Maybe you get to a dozen legitimate issues that we could look at. We have prepared, because we administer the program, a whole host of scenarios, and it really is it gets down to a menu of what one would pick and choose, and within a couple of hours we could probably get the issues narrowed down. Whether or not we could then agree was kind of where we left things yesterday with a smaller group of interested members, but that shouldn't take much more than a couple of hours to walk through the options. We are willing. We've obviously met with some members to that end, but we would continue to be willing to sit down and talk about things.
Well, I don't know what the rest of the committee wants to do, but that's one of the things that comes out of that is, in at least my looking at it, is the frustration that and the problem with the geographic cost differential is it's one of the only big drivers that happens now. And the effect is that all the other things that you have to do in the long term are much smaller, because they start based on 2% of the employees this year and 4% next year and 6% the next year, and they take forever to do anything. But I don't know whether people want to go through that complete exercise or not. I'm afraid that it's going to take that kind of an exercise to get the support to eventually pass a package. Senator Frank?
I don't know if we're talking about, as Senator Rieger indicates, are we just talking about the things that the administration will accept, or are we talking about a broader list of ideas? Should we be debating just this narrow group that the administration supports, or should we be talking about a much broader group of long-term systemic changes? I think that's one of our central questions.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to characterize our list as a list that we supported. It is a list of options, a menu of options.
And we might want to add to the list. But yeah, when we don't have a list, it's hard to add to it. All we have is what's in the bill so far.
Well, maybe we should get a list from the administration of things that they would support. Or are you suggesting that we should not get into that until some later date?
Mr. Chairman, the quickest money that's related to pay is the money available statewide from a change in the geographic differential. We know that. Any other savings that relate to employer costs or downstream and incremental, as has been characterized, and
I mean, they want to cut the pay in Fairbanks 4%.
Statewide.
They want to cut pay in Barrow by about 20%. Why don't you just cut the pay by everybody in the state, by 3% or 2% or something? I mean, if that's what you want to do.
That's not what we care to do, Mr. Chairman. There's no empirical driver that would suggest that an across-the-board reduction in pay is warranted. There is empirical data which suggests that the differentials in the areas that were outlined should be readjusted. This committee took a strong position a month ago against paying people benefits to which they aren't entitled. In that case, it had to do with the geographic differential of the marine highway system and the thought that some of those people who had been receiving the benefit weren't entitled to it because of residency. The issue is the same here, Mr. Chairman. You've got a differential that's being paid to some people out of whack with the marketplace, has no resemblance to the marketplace, and I would suggest that that's at least as much a problem as people in the ferry system who were receiving a benefit to which they were not entitled given the residency. The market does not demonstrate the kind of differentials that these people are. We're not talking about just receiving today. Some of these people have been receiving this dividend or this benefit since 1972. And the committee's on the record fairly strong and fairly aggressive, I might add, in opposition to the former.
Further questions? Senator Jarrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the concern that keeps coming back to me is, is this bill here, I know it was one that was previously dealt with, but is it technically before us under the call? And I don't know that that's been resolved. And, certainly that there are ways that the call can be changed. Of course, the governor can amend the call, or the legislature can amend the call. Both processes are going to take some time and some negotiating to work out whatever differences there are. But I would like, if possible, to see all these major items here as all separate entities. That's just my personal feeling, and then we deal with them on a case-by-case basis. One thing I am very much concerned about, though, is that although we're talking about this affecting future employees, those are the ones I'm concerned there, that we don't start losing the pool out there to make sure that the state has people that are comfortable working for the state, that have the expertise and the knowledge to continue to make the state a viable entity in this in the global world. We can end up losing more than we're trying to save by taking some of these measures. And of course, all this comes out in the discussion. But I guess what gets down to me right now, the concern that I have, is that is this something that is technically before us at this point? And I still don't know if that's right, what the answer is to that.
I would suggest that the answer is that if this bill is not technically before us, then the rest of its contents are not technically before us either.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm talking to the substitute that was introduced.
There are substantive provisions in this bill that include the approval of the contracts as well as the funding mechanisms. And if the bill were determined to be outside of the call and that were defective in some way, if it went through the process without an amendment to the call and were challenged, the challenge would defeat all of the provisions of the bill.
That's why I'm suggesting there that if that's the case, then we deal with some of those issues on a case-by-case basis or deal with them separately.
Senator Sharp, did you have a question or what were you?
I might have.
Any of the committee members have any suggestions? Senator Donnelly?
Something that hasn't been done. I think we have one time since statehood, and we could get 2/3 agreement among the legislature, which should be on the agenda for a special session. We call ourselves in a special session and deal with what we need to deal with.
13, we need one more.
Senator Sharp.
That a little bit of talking about definition of state resident that's on line 15, page 3.
Line 15, page 3.
Does this actually, it refers to a section in the permanent fund and first reference AS 110055 is another reference in that section, little e there. But I thought we were going to tie it to eligibility, overall eligibility of the permanent fund. This doesn't look like it tightens it up that tight. It looks like it just says if in section 8 of the permanent fund statute, it says what a state resident means. Qualify, but I thought we were going to tighten it up further. It says that they shall have received a permanent fund dividend.
I think we should tighten it up just as far for this as we wanted to for BP.
As far as we what?
Just as far as we did for BP.
North Star contract.
True. It still wasn't tight enough for some of us.
Well,
this one may actually have.
But this one means we're going to pay more property more in certain instances, since it would be a minus 20% if they weren't a state resident, and it would be zero or plus percentage if they were. So there's a lot more economic benefit to make it a little tighter and make sure they qualify. And I don't see where this tightens it down to the point that it says simply, if you received a permanent fund check, you're eligible for the differential. If you didn't, you don't. This goes back to the mumble jumble of intent to stay in Alaska and all that situation that really has a window wide enough to drive a truck through. I mean, either they get the permanent fund or they don't, and that means you're an Alaska resident or you're not to get to qualify for this. And that makes it understandable for everybody, including me, to understand.
The only problem is the Constitution has a much broader window than most of us would like to have it have. And that's probably the trouble.
It doesn't seem to affect it for permanent fund for a year. Eligibility, that's constitutional.
Permanent fund is not either a welfare-based entitlement or an employment opportunity. We've lost on occupational licensing. We've lost on things that are based on commerce, trade, or welfare to a much higher standard than we can maintain on the dividend or on a fish and game license, for example.
Is that because we receive federal funds that we can't do that? And a lot of federal funds mixed in with our salaries that we pay out?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's based on the right to pursue an occupation, the right to a trade, the right to work. I think those things are subject to a higher level of scrutiny constitutionally with regard to residency. Senator Donnelly has been through this over and over again and can probably explain it a lot better than I can. But in my memory, the two worst things or the hardest things to discriminate on are basically welfare and work. Senator Donnelly?
Emergency care benefits.
Okay.
You can't say if you're a new person in an area discriminated against them for emergency service.
But working for the state isn't emergency service. It's not welfare, I hope. So, you know, where are we? It just seems to me, I thought that was the original rhetoric that we heard, that we were going to tighten it down to avoid the problem. Eligibility for permanent fund would be the easiest way to go, and I don't see it in here. So as long as we're not missing an opportunity to make it simple.
I think when we were dealing with a contract term that was more of threatened enforcement after the fact, we could probably get away with a lot more. I'm worried that the Department of Law would tell us we can't do what we'd like to do in an actual employment contract.
Even if it's in a negotiated agreement?
I don't know. Maybe in a negotiated agreement, it's different. But that's in the area of an education that I don't have.
And Mr. Chairman, too, the residency requirement for a receipt of the permanent fund dividend is a reflexive. It looks back and asks whether or not you were at a time and remain and continue and or will continue to be a resident. And to have that strict element here would have made some ineligible to receive the differential alongside those who would qualify under the strictest definition, each doing the same job, and so you begin to violate like pay for like work protections, and by phrasing it in the way that it's characterized here, it allows us to pay those individuals similarly as they work in real time, and for a number of months, it could be an entire year, that a worker might receive the benefit before he or she made application for the permanent fund dividend or certified under the program. This program has a certification element now under this program, or these guidelines, that one would then have an opportunity to certify that he or she was, in fact, a state resident, met the certain criteria, answered a form that looks a lot like the PFD form itself. And then if a person, the first check would be the PFD division, where we would send those, let's say it's 100 or 720 employees of the Marine Highway System, you'd send those applications electronically to PFD, the enforcement people, qualifications folks, and those that had not received a benefit before would just receive a red flag, called to the attention then of the Marine Highway System, who then would do an additional review of those applicants to see whether or not, in fact, they were just new residents that otherwise should be entitled to the benefit or not. So it allows some flexibility so that you don't end up having a situation where you violate people's rights to the equal pay for the same work in real time.
Senator Sharp?
I can go along with that, but you know, you read over and over again how we want to hold industry and private enterprise to Alaska Hire. And I think the state is one of the worst offenders there is as far as Alaska Hire. I see in a paper, here's a new supervisor we brought in. By the way, he's been living the state outside for 8 years, but boy, he sure is an expert on everything. And we bring him in here, and they are, or they've been out of state for 2 or 3 years, or they never have been in the state, worse yet. It's just, I mean, it isn't something that's unusual, it's something that's common when you read about and hired, and especially in the upper echelon area.
As Senator Donnelly says, we do it all the way up to commissioners.
Well, not the commissioner in front of us, I know that.
I don't mean
that. Chairman, I agree with Senator Sharp, but you look at the municipalities too, and guilty, I guess, in that area as well. There's a lot of city managers come from out of state.
Yeah.
So I wish it was just a state that had that problem. But I think with the North Star, we dealt with that in intent language. It was not in the bill itself.
Yeah, that's I think a major portion of that.
Yeah.
Further questions of the commissioner?
I don't know
whether we're going to come back to this with a whole list in front of us or not. I think that's the way to deal with it, but I think there's a lot of negotiating going on at the same time that we all have to do. But for the people that aren't involved in those negotiating sessions, the problem is finding money up front, and that's why the geographic cost differential keeps coming up, because it is the only big upfront generator of dollars. With that, we're recessed to the call of the chair.